We'll begin to take a trip to the moon, and we're going to begin that trip with a sort of summary slide that illustrates the beginning of an Apollo mission to the moon, in this particular case the Apollo 17 mission. The Saturn V rocket and the spacecraft, which were up here in this section, was truly a remarkable achievement technologically and from a human point of view. The first thing I want to remind you of, those of you that are familiar with the movie Apollo 13, is that in that movie you might have gotten the impression that the people of Apollo, particularly those in mission control and the engineers and others who were working Apollo diligently, were in their late 30s and early 40s. In actual fact, they were in their 20s. They were just out of engineering school in various places in the United States, and indeed actually throughout the world. There were a significant number of Australians and others who came to the United States in response to the challenge that President John Kennedy gave us in 1961 to go to the moon and return safely to Earth. And that program was not only internationalized by that a small migration of engineers and skilled workers, but also by the sample analysis program and many other activities that were truly made into international efforts. The Saturn V rocket, however, is still the largest rocket ever to be used to take human beings into space. It weighed 6.8 million pounds, fully fueled, about 364 feet high. It had thrust in the five big engines here of 7.5 million pounds when they were ignited and at full thrust. This building in which it was assembled at the time and for many decades afterwards was the largest contained space constructed by man on Earth. It has since been eclipsed, I'm sorry to say, by a mall in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And not to be satisfied with that, they're enlarging it. But this vehicle assembly building is fully utilized today. That's where all the space shuttles are assembled prior to their flight. We had a great deal of different types of training, most of it in computer-driven simulators that mimicked in very, very profound ways and very useful ways our spacecraft. But we also, by the time Apollo 13 literally was training for their flight to the moon, we had a training program in science that used up about 3 or 4 or 5 days a month. The whole program was aimed at making as good field geologists out of these test pilots that we had inherited. The scientists like myself had inherited because of the original test and political nature of Apollo. Making as good field geologists out of them as we possibly could. And indeed, even though I was the only scientist to go to the moon, the astronauts from Neil Armstrong on all did an outstanding job in gathering the samples, in taking the photography, and indeed often making very, very profound observations that ultimately led to a first-order understanding of this small planet. Here you see Gene Cernan and myself out near Flagstaff, Arizona, in a simulated exercise using a working model of the lunar roving vehicle. Why Gene felt he had to wear these checkered pants on trips like this, I have no idea. These Navy test pilots, if you've ever known one, are of a different breed. We also had something called survival training. And by the way, those of you over here to the left can't see these pictures, either because I'm in the way or because you're too far to the left. So don't hesitate to get up if you feel uncomfortable. Move to the back of the room or someplace to see it. If there's some kids and some young people in the audience who would like to come up closer, we already have a few up here. Don't hesitate to come up as well. They really are pretty nice pictures. But in this case, you see some very young and somewhat skeptical-looking astronauts learning about the care, feeding, and preparation of boa constrictor. Each of the astronauts in that picture ultimately went to the moon. Except, I'm sorry, Vance Brand, who's on the left, he and I trained for Apollo 15 together, but he ended up being a commander on several space shuttle flights. The boa constrictor, as you probably know, many of you, I'm sure, have experienced some of the exotic animals of the world, and they all are reputed to taste like chicken. Boa constrictor actually does taste like chicken, although, albeit very stringy chicken. The launch of Apollo 17 took place on December 7th, 1972, the 30-year anniversary this December. At this point in the mission, about 12 to 14 seconds into the launch, the actual G-loading or acceleration is very minimal, but the extremely heavy vibration at this, because of the interaction of the plumes of the five first-stage engines. That vibration is similar, and I was using this expression up until about 24 hours ago, is similar to driving your Land Rover or other four-wheel drive vehicle down a railroad track on the ties. Well, I'm told that ties don't mean anything in Australia. I have to call them sleepers. Now you know what I'm talking about, right? I didn't know what I was talking about, obviously. It really is a very, very heavy vibration. At 2 minutes and 45 seconds, the acceleration reaches four times gravity. We shut off this first stage rocket. We actually decelerate a little bit at 1.5 times gravity. And then the second stage rocket kicks in, and we're going again at about 1.5 times gravity, positive Gs. All of that change happens in just over a second. That gets your attention. You know why you're wearing seat belts and shoulder harnesses, believe me. But in 10 minutes, we're in orbit around the Earth. I'm not going to take you on an orbital trip of the Earth. I think probably some of you have had that already from some of the Australian astronauts who have been in space using the space shuttle. I'll keep trying to improve the focus of these pictures. It seems to want to hold out a little bit. This picture actually was taken over the eastern South Pacific on one of our two orbits of the Earth. But I do want you to look up there at that band, the blue in the upper left-hand corner of the picture. It is our atmosphere looking directly through it, and I'll call it to your attention a little bit later when we get to the moon. Once we had accelerated from our orbital velocity of 18,000 miles an hour to a velocity of 25,000 miles an hour, so that we would actually be able to get out of the Earth's influence, gravitational influence, and into that of the moon, we undocked from the rocket, or detached ourselves would be a better term, moved away from the end of the third stage rocket, turned around, and came back in to retrieve the lunar module, which you see there tucked away in the end of that rocket. I also want to draw your attention to those bright spots around the rocket. They are pieces of ice that formed on the rocket while it was sitting on the launch pad in Florida, a very humid climate, and with the very, very cold liquid hydrogen tanks on this rocket as well as the others, a great deal of frost formed on the Saturn V. Most of that came off during that heavy vibration phase that I mentioned previously, but some of it, obviously, stayed with us as we went on our trajectory to the moon. Some of you may recall that when John Glenn went over Australia back in the Mercury days, the earliest American space program, he reported seeing what he thought might be fireflies in orbit with him. I suspect John was seeing his own little cloud of ice that he was traveling with in orbit. But then again, he and I served in the Senate together, representing different parties. He does come from the other party, and seeing fireflies might be explainable by that. This picture of a nearly full Earth is one that I took from about 34,000 miles away. Looking back, you can see that at the bottom of the picture, the Antarctic and South Pole, all of the continent of Africa is visible. Up in the upper right portion of the picture is a spiral pattern that is a typhoon or hurricane going ashore in India. And as you can see, we really do have a very, very good observation platform when you're on your way to the moon. It took us 3.5 days to get to the moon, and about 24 hours after this picture was taken, I was able to take this one, which will look a little more familiar to you. you got it. That's your home continent of Australia right there. But why is it covered with clouds? This is December when this picture was taken. And actually, those clouds disappeared very fast the next day, and we had an excellent view of Australia all the way to the moon. If you know your geography, these spots right here are the Philippine Islands, and right there is a very, very tightly, intensely organized typhoon that was known as Teresa. And you already know that some years later, I married a woman named Teresa. And there may have been some premonition in watching this typhoon sit in the Philippine Sea for about 3 days as we went to the moon. Additionally, there's a typhoon being organized here near Guam, which nobody knew about. And so we did contribute a little bit to the weather forecasting of the Pacific by identifying that particular body. Once we had reached the vicinity of the moon, our first task was, of course, to go into orbit. Here you see the mountains of the moon crossing the Earth, now at a somewhat smaller phase. And that is what we called LOS, loss of signal, because for the next 45 minutes, there was no radio communication with the Earth on each of the two-hour orbits around the moon. And that actually was pretty nice. Houston can often ask you to do things you'd just rather not do. And as long as nothing was going wrong, we were very, very happy for that silence. Landing in the Valley of Torres Litoral was reasonably straightforward for us. We had, the benefit of the experience from many other, several other missions. Our landing point was going to be right there where that red dot is between those two craters. If you look carefully, that is the other spacecraft. Ron Evans is all alone in that spacecraft now, as he would be for the next approximately 75 hours. In this particular case, he's below us, a little bit ahead of us, and he's taking some final navigational sightings on the landing area, which ultimately we used, was fed into our computer after being processed on the Earth, fed into our computer, and then the next orbit of the moon, we begin our descent into the Valley of Torres Litoral. Well, this picture actually got out of sequence, and I apologize that for a little bit. This is a sunrise on the far side of the moon, and the reason I was going to show it, and am showing it, is to draw your attention that there is no band of blue around the moon. The moon's gravity is only 1/6 that of the Earth. That means many different things. One is that these young people here would only weigh 1/6 their weight if they were on the moon, which isn't very much. And, of course, any of you, if you were on the moon, would only weigh 1/6 of what you weigh here. But it also means there's no atmosphere being held to the moon. The vacuum at the surface of the moon is essentially that of deep space. A very, very hard vacuum. And as a result, there's none of the oxidation that we're used to here on Earth as a result of oxygen. So the desert of the moon, which literally we're looking at, an extraordinarily dry desert, no water at all, is not as colorful as we're used to here on Earth. Now back to the surface of the moon. This picture is the first picture that I took as I looked out of the spacecraft after landing. Gives you, a very good feeling for the nature of the surface that we had landed on, and indeed several of the other missions had landed on similar types of surfaces in other parts of the moon. It's a covering of pulverized rock, overlying lavas that we call basalts here on Earth, and I actually think I've seen some similar types of rocks and some road cuts as we drove around Melbourne the last few hours. In this case, however, these rocks have absolutely no water in them, which is unusual for the Earth. In fact, you always find some water in Earth rocks. And in the case of this particular landing site, the rocks are full of the element titanium as well, much more so than normal. The base of this mountain here is about 4 to 5 kilometers away. You're going to have to take my word for that, because there are just no houses or telephone poles by which you could judge the distance any better than we could when we were there. Judging distance in this kind of a situation is very difficult, and so you're very dependent on the measurements that you make from your maps and photographs. The metallic-looking object in the foreground is one of 16 small rockets we had around the spacecraft that allowed us to control the orientation of our spacecraft while we were actually in flight. This is our home. This was our home. I just want to be sure you saw it while we were on the moon. It's a great camp. Geologists always think of their home as a camp, and I'm sure my wife thinks that's what I think our home is sometimes. But in this case, it was very comfortable. 1/6 gravity is a great environment in which to sleep. Just enough weight so you feel like you're sleeping on something, but not enough that you would want to toss and turn at all. The food was reasonably good, freeze-dried, dehydrated food that we just added water to and were able to eat quite easily. And maybe most importantly for geologists, and maybe for some of you, there are no black flies up there to bite. By the way, that debris layer that's on top of the rock averages about 9 meters deep. And I guess I should apologize for giving you a whole bunch of different units here, but we build our rockets using the English system of measure. We flew them using a nautical system of measure, and we worked on the moon using a metric system of measure. And how we got through the whole Apollo program without getting all that confused, I don't know. But we did, and maybe we were just paying more attention than those who had a recent Mars flight get confused because of the transfer of units. This picture you have to look at, largely because I like to look at it, but it also, I think, demonstrates that desert-like quality of the moon. In this case, there are large blocks of this lava, basalt, around a crater that actually lies off to the left. It's about 600 meters in diameter. And there in the middle ground is the lunar roving vehicle. This antenna here is pointed directly back to the Earth, and at the time was transmitting television pictures of our activities in this boulder field. This picture illustrates several things. One, it illustrates your home, only 400,000 kilometers away. Being homesick really didn't present a problem, but communications were so good that might explain some of that, and we were also extremely busy. The other thing I want to point out to you that I should have pointed out earlier with some of the pictures of the Earth is that when you're actually in space, when you see the Earth, it's against an absolute black background. In this background, there's still some color. There's still some light coming through. Even the pictures that you see printed, the background is not an absolute black, unlike space. And so we had a much better contrast of what we saw with respect to the Earth, as well as much better detail while we were in space. And so if you want to see that kind of view, you're just going to have to go into space. Because so far, we haven't been able to bring back a photograph that does it justice. Now, some friends of mine and I are trying to get the original film that we used in space digitized, and so it may be that in a year or two, we will have truly representative pictures of rather than just some of these multi-generation photographs that you see now. Gene Cernan is seen here testing out the lunar roving vehicle. It was a very fine four-wheel drive field vehicle for us. Each wheel had an independent electric motor, independent suspension. We had front and rear wheel steering if we needed it, and could drive about 10 or 12 kilometers an hour over this surface. Now, that may not sound like very much, but remember, we're driving in 1/6 gravity. So anytime you hit a bump, you're going to be off the surface for a while. And you just have to be very careful about that. Make sure you're not rotating at the same time that you hit a bump. We took this up to about 18 kilometers an hour downhill once and regretted it. It was a little bit too fast. Getting on the lunar rover was reasonably straightforward. Here you see me having been standing at the side of the rover, jumping up into the vacuum with a little bit of leftward translation and hoping that I'm going to come down in the seat assigned to me. We learned how to operate in 1/6 gravity pretty fast, and everything worked fairly well, fairly efficiently, in spite of the stiff suit and other problems. This is a television camera that was used to send pictures back to Earth. It was operated remotely from the Earth. We didn't fool with it very much. Some experimental gear out here on the back. The post for the antenna. This is called an Omni antenna. That was what we used while we were driving. It allowed us to communicate during that time, but not to send television pictures back. One of the problems we had with commanders during these missions was that they seemed to like to break fenders off of lunar rovers. And here you see that had happened to us, but also you can see that with the help of some of my friends on Earth, we figured out how to repair it, and that was by taping together some unneeded photo maps with gray duct tape. You all know what duct tape is, right? Yeah. Figured that. It's probably holding this building together, as a matter of fact. It certainly was holding a fender together on the moon. Needless to say, we became honorary members of most automotive repair organizations in the United States. The reason we had to have this was that these particles of dust and rock in the debris layer on the moon would actually adhere to this wheel, this wire wheel, long enough to give you a forward rooster tail, or driving into your own dust would have become routine. That just was not really acceptable. You didn't want to get that dirty, even though we ended up getting quite dirty anyway. This is what a well-dressed astronaut wears on the moon before, and certainly cleaner than I was when we ended the excursion. This was actually on our first excursion. The weight of the suit, my weight inside it, and the backpack all totaled about 370 Earth pounds. But on the moon, that's only about 61 pounds. So you can maybe understand why we seem to be having such a great time when we're up there. It's a lot easier than training. And I found that at that weight and with the mobility, the even limited mobility I had in the legs and the hip of this suit, that I could run across the surface like a cross-country skier would run, gliding above the surface, and get speeds routinely of about 6 kilometers an hour, and probably without too much trouble, if I had needed to in an emergency, could have sustained about 10 kilometers an hour for some extended period of time. The suit is obviously not a perfect set of clothing to wear anywhere, but still gave us that kind of mobility. The biggest problem we had was using the gloves, which was basically a balloon, and any time you wanted to pick something up, you had to squeeze against the pressure in the glove, and that was like squeezing a tennis ball continuously. So your forearm muscles got quite fatigued as a result, but with no residual soreness the next day, which was very nice. Now you can rotate it back a little bit so they can see for scale. On the left, there should be an astronaut, namely yours truly. There he is. To give you an idea of how big this boulder is, these boulders roll down the sides of the mountains. Nice, very convenient for geologists in that all we had to do was look back up the mountain, see the track that they had left, and trace it right back up to where they came from. It was a very useful tool for geologists. Those of you who are real close, if you look right there just above my red dot, that's the lunar module. It's about 5 kilometers away, about 5 kilometers away from this site. These boulder tracks, this one was about 1.5 kilometers long, and if you look carefully, you can see my footprints going down into that track, out of sight, and up the other side. Those footprints will stay in recognizable form for about 1 million years, maybe 2 million years. The only uniform erosion that occurs on the moon is the rain of small micrometeors. And over that period of time, 1 million, 2 million years, they will gradually stir up or garden about a centimeter or two of the surface, and those footprints will gradually disappear. But that's not too bad. Not too bad. 1 million years, I sincerely doubt that my footprints in Washington, if they were left at all, will last that long. Now, the mountain back here, the South Massif, is the highest mountain in the area. All the mountains were up to 2,000 to 2,100 meters high. This was the highest, over 2,100 meters. Had most of its slopes were about a constant 26 degrees. There are small craters all over this surface, much like moguls in a snowfield. And so one might seriously consider skiing the moon if you get there for some other reason. And I suspect some of our some young people alive today on Earth will have that privilege sometime, if we do our job right. Looking out of the window again after two excursions, you get an idea a different idea of the nature of the lunar surface. Over here, it's relatively undisturbed, and that has a very high bearing strength. You can walk across that, as you can here. But with all the activity that we've had in and around the lunar module, we have fluffed this surface up significantly. Still will hold a nice footprint. If you look carefully, you'll see some footprints in here. Slightly cohesive material, a lot like damp beach sand, just to give you a feeling for what it was like. However, there's the dust in this. Most of this material is less than 100 microns in diameter. That is, it is extremely fine dust. It penetrates like graphite lubricant, but of course with the opposite effect if you haven't sealed against it. The lunar rover had sealed bearings, and they work fine. So there are engineering solutions to dealing with that dust, but it is still something that everybody who goes to the moon is going to have to worry about. Remember, there's no atmosphere on the moon, so it doesn't billow around you. But it's still there, and it's still going to be causing some difficulties in the future. Well, the last picture I took before we left the moon is this one. It looks back towards the science station and towards the west, science station that we left on the moon. You can see our tracks going back to that station as well in other directions here just before we left the moon. But Lee, we had to after 72 hours on the surface, 22 hours outside the spacecraft, and we were blasted off from the moon. This is a picture taken from a television monitor in the Mission Control Center in Houston. Not a very good picture. Now, my comrade Gene Cernan suggested I go outside and get a really good picture of liftoff, but I figured that that was probably not an appropriate time to do that. Maybe somebody else can do that on another program. Well, we've got the lunar module obscured somewhat. There you go, by the grill. That's all that was left. It was called the ascent stage. That took us up into orbit to meet with Ron Evans, who was in this spacecraft, somewhat larger and heavier, but still a very, very comfortable craft to work in weightlessness, in zero gravity. All we brought back to Earth was this cone, shiny cone-shaped object here called a command module. In this particular equipment bay were some cameras that were used by Ron Evans to remotely sense materials on the lunar surface. Ron was our chow hound. He loved to eat. We were afraid there would be no food left when we got back. He did leave a little bit for us, ate all the good stuff. Bacon squares. I know bacon squares don't sound like they'd be very good, but when there's nothing spicy in your diet up there, you were looking forward to something with a little taste to it. He also, in this particular picture, is demonstrating using a bag of salmon salad, which was our demonstration bag of choice, because nobody ate salmon salad. It always appeared in our menus, but nobody ate it. We never ordered it. NASA must have bought an immense amount of salmon salad. And so when you go to museums here on Earth and happen to look at the food that astronauts eat, particularly those from Apollo, and you happen to see salmon salad there, don't assume it was what we like. Just take it from me. Assume it's something we brought back without eating. But here he's demonstrating a problem of hydrogen in our water. Our water was made, along with our electricity, in a battery-type device called a fuel cell. Many of you have probably heard of fuel cells. They're talked about a lot in this day and age as in the future of transportation systems. But we used them, of course, way back in the Gemini program, as a matter of fact, and they were a fundamental system of importance in Apollo. But a little bit of hydrogen always ended up in our water, since the fuel cell worked by combining hydrogen and water, again, to make hydrogen and oxygen, again, to make electricity and water. And the reason that we were concerned about this, or at least we pretended to be concerned about it, was that any time you eat hydrogen, it's going to have to come out, much to the discomfort of your crewmates. We kept pointing out to the engineers that although they'd done a remarkable job in Apollo overall, they had not yet figured out how to keep hydrogen out of our water and therefore out of our tummies. But we entered the atmosphere at 35,000 miles an hour. Remember, we left at 25,000. We entered at 35 because we were coming back a little bit earlier to catch up on our recovery schedule. At that speed, we actually flew this spacecraft down here that I hope most of you can still see. We flew it like a wing. It did indeed have a lift vector, for those of you who are pilots. And we could fly it, but in the case of entry, we flew it with the lift vector down, so we were made sure we were captured in the atmosphere. We did not want to skip out of the atmosphere. That would not have been a good idea. And in doing so, we pulled about 7 times gravity. That was the most gravitational pull that we had in the entire mission. But then, from then on, the computer just flew this spacecraft to where it believed the carrier was, and indeed it knew exactly where the carrier was, so much so that the Navy started parking their carriers about 5 miles away from our impact point. Some concern that we might land on their nice, clean deck, I guess. Splashdown of Apollo 17 is shown here, and indeed was the end of the Apollo programs to the moon. Really a remarkable period, I think, in all seriousness, of what we with what was accomplished during that time. Here, an afterthought to the ending is the frogmen or Navy SEALs from the carrier Ticonderoga that were in the water immediately upon our splashdown to make sure that we were secure and that the spacecraft was secure with the lunar samples in it. The history of Apollo, you've already seen this picture. It was bid upon remarkably and very with great appreciation by all of us a few moments ago. This picture, though, does summarize a great deal about the history of Apollo. If you look very carefully, there's Gene Cernan, who took the picture, reflected in my visor. So it shows both of us there on the moon. We obtained a first-order understanding of the moon as a small planet. We built a huge base of technology that is still stood upon today to do remarkable things here on Earth. The flag of the United States symbolizes not only what America did at that time, but also what young men and women can do when they believe the challenge they have been given is the most important challenge they can meet with their lives. And that indeed was probably one of the most essential ingredients of Apollo. Management discipline, good design, good operations, that was all important. But not if we had not had those young men and women that I mentioned earlier, it probably would never have happened. And above the flag is a picture of the Earth, maybe more familiarly seen as an Earthrise from behind the moon. This also symbolizes a new status that we have in our universe, at least in our solar system. We know now that we can live on the moon, that settlements could form there and be independent of the Earth. That same is true for Mars. The Mars Society that has sponsored my visit here in Australia truly, I think, believes that that's going to happen, or you wouldn't have such an enthusiastic group of, about 120 people now who are doing all sorts of extremely diverse and interesting things in Australia relative to the future habitation of Mars. But we haven't quite decided overall as a species what we're going to do with this new status that we have. We certainly have the will and the ability to go into deep space to stay, but we haven't quite decided when that's going to happen. I think it is only a question of time. And so with that, it may be time that we begin to think about another walk on the moon, and I would be more than happy to take a few questions before we let you all go for the evening. Thank you very much.